Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, a variety of subjects covered with Benjamin Perper checking out music and poetry in Joshua Tree, Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with comedian Gad Elmaleh, and to start, Emmanuel also found out recently about bugs. Lots of them.
Joining us today is author Michael S. Engel. Michael is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and senior curator of entomology at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. Michael is here to talk about his latest book, Innumerable Insects, the story of the most diverse and myriad animals on Earth. Thank you for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you are more than welcome. This is something very interesting to me, and I guess everybody who has ever seen an insect. So let's talk about it. I understand that you are a research affiliate at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And for the layperson in your field, what does a research affiliate do?
Well, it's just basically an associated researcher. And so the American Museum and I partner in terms of various research enterprises.
Okay. I think I got that.
Okay. They were my employers before I came to Kansas, and so they didn't want to entirely let me go.
Oh, okay. Now, you have pretty much what seems to be a fascination with the insect world. How did that come about, and when did it begin?
Well, I think most entomologists can rightly say that they probably collected insects as a kid, but that was not me. I did not do that at all. I was not really a bug kid. And it wasn't until I went to college and interacted with a few influential professors that I realized there's this incredible diversity around me. You can truly say sort of the scales fell from my eyes, and I realized that there is this hidden world all around that we know very little about.
Since this started later for you, how did you just come in to say, you know what, these things are really interesting to me personally? And what did you find interesting? What got you started? What was there a particular bug, insect?
For me, it was a discovery about the diversity of bees. Among the various insects that I study, I think I could honestly say bees are my favorite. And when I learned that there was a lot more out there than just honeybees and bumblebees, that it really kind of struck me, like, oh my goodness, there's this incredible variety, from nocturnal bees that pollinate plants at night, to fire bees, to sweat bees, to carpenter bees, and there's this incredible rich panoply out there that no one ever really talked about, and that really helped inspire me, and that new species were being discovered all the time, and so I really wanted to engage with that.
You do have bees and so many more listed. I'm curious, why are bees so important to the world?
Well, they are the preeminent pollinators. 90% of all pollination is done by animals, and among those animals, insects are paramount among the pollinators, and bees are sort of the classic example. They are critical in all ecosystems throughout the world, and not only do they make our forests and meadows and deserts blossom, but they are primarily responsible for our agricultural crops. And so every third bite of food that you take is due to the action of some pollinator, be it an amazing little bee or a butterfly or a beetle or even some of the true flies. You know, we think of house flies as being a pest, but their relatives go out and pollinate our crops and our forests. So pollination through insects is vital for our planet, and bees play a really critical role in that.
Well, this raises an interesting question for me. Are there literally insects such as bees that we can't live without?
Yeah, most insects, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
We need them, and it is fair to say that our survival is dependent upon their success. If humans left the Earth today, the Earth would flourish. If insects packed up and left, the planet would literally become toxic, wither, and die. So they are vital to the success of life on Earth.
Okay. Now, you have so many things in the book, But before I go any further about asking more about some of these insects, what was it about these insects or all insects that led you to write this wonderfully illustrated book?
Well, insects, even though they are the dominant form of life on this earth, they tend to pass without being noticed. And probably because of their diminutive size, we ignore them. They, you know, pollinate our crops, but we really don't pay attention to them. They live in our homes. They, you know, they till our soils. They augment our atmospheres. And again, we just don't pay them any attention, just like we don't pay attention to our breathing every day. It's not until they do something annoying that suddenly then we pay attention to them. A termite eats our house, and then we pay attention to them. And so the effort here is sort of twofold. One, to tell the rich story of insect diversity and hopefully help people appreciate this incredible panoply of species that surrounds them every day and how vital they are and how quite amazing they are. Right. But at the same time, to highlight this amazing resource in the American Museum of Natural History, their rich, rare book collection, where they have some of the original works by which many entomological discoveries were made. And unlike today, where if you go out and you make a discovery, you can take a photograph of the insect doing whatever it is. Mm-hmm. In the past, that was not possible. And so artists had to come and faithfully render these insects. And what they produced were not only great scientific works, but amazing examples of artistic expression.
Okay.
And so they're really quite beautiful to look at.
Yes, they are. And as you just mentioned about the drawings and all, I wanted to ask you, where does the detailed illustrative artwork in this book come from? Can you speak on that a little bit more?
I wish the artwork was my own, but it's the work it's the collective work of many entomologists and artists throughout history who have gone to make the various discoveries that I report in the book. So, for example, in discussing complete metamorphosis with insects, it's a great opportunity to highlight the adventure and the, you know, risking of life and limb that researchers in the 1600s undertook in order to go about and make these discoveries, to elucidate the complete details of metamorphosis and this change in life from a larva to a winged adult, and the beautiful illustrations that they used to document these natural history discoveries they were making. And in that case, it's a wonderful tale of a woman, Maria Miriam, okay, who grabbed her daughters, shipped off from Amsterdam in the late 1600s for Suriname, lived in the jungle until she got sick with malaria, came back, and then documented everything that she discovered. And it's quite an amazing scientific tale.
Wow. Have you gone out in the field and done the same?
Yeah, I've been to over 40 countries, either up in the Arctic Circle or down to the equator, all in hunt of living and fossil insects to play my own small part in this greater tale.
Well, have you discovered something that was previously unknown?
Yes. With insects, it's easy to do. Not that the work is easy, but discoveries are everywhere. You know, from your own backyard to the deserts of Arabia or to the tropical forests of Central Africa, there are new species of insects being discovered all the time. Thousands of new species are documented every year. And with each of these species, as well as those that we've already documented, we're discovering things about their habits, their lifestyles, where they occur, what they do, how they negatively or positively impact other species, us as being perhaps the one that we're most curious about.
Right. So may I ask, what specifically have you discovered?
Oh, goodness. I've discovered the oldest insect in the world, a fossil from 410 million years ago.
Okay.
I've discovered new species of living and fossil bees. You pick it, and I've probably done a little bit of it. I kind of dabbled throughout the entomological world during the course of my career.
Okay. We'll get back to that in just a moment. Michael, will you take just a moment and let our listeners know where they can find more information about you and your book, Innumerable Insects?
Well, the book can be purchased anywhere books are found,
okay.
Particularly today in the usual online sources. And as for me, I can be found at the University of Kansas Natural History Museum's website at www.ku.edu. And more information on insects and the wonderful rich library from which these rare books were drawn can be found at the American Museum of Natural History, www.amnh.org.
All right, thank you.
That was Manuel Rogers in conversation with author Michael S. Engel. Again, his new book, Innumerable Insects, the story of the most diverse myriad animals on Earth. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we have Manuel Rogers in conversation with French comedian Gad Elmaleh in the region soon. First, though, we have Benjamin Perper checking out an afternoon with music and poetry presented by Lauren Henley and Jonathan Maul. That's at the Joshua Tree Art Gallery, November 17th.
Tell us about the event on the 17th. What will you be reading?
Sure. So on November 17th at 3 p.m. at the Joshua Tree Art Gallery in Joshua Tree, Jonathan and I will be doing a poetry reading together, and it will also involve some percussion. Jonathan will be playing his hang drum. I'm going to be reading from my first book, actually. It's sometimes fun to go back in time and read some of your earlier stuff. And I'll be reading from Desert with a Cabin View, which was written in Joshua Tree in a cabin shortly after Jonathan and I were married. What are you going to be reading, Jonathan?
I'm glad you asked. I'll be reading from my book, Dog Star, but probably just a couple poems. I'm going to be reading mostly new stuff and, you know, playing on the hang drum. So it'll be fun. Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and we'll have light refreshments. I make some really amazing chocolate. So I'll be bringing in some chocolate, maybe a little bit of wine, and some coffee. And it's very limited seating, so people should come early or BYOC chair.
BYO chair.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or just get ready to stand. But it's a beautiful space, and we hope to have a great turnout.
I've always wanted to know this. What is it like being in a marriage between two poets? Is it difficult? Do you guys find yourself feeding off each other? What's that like?
You know, it works for us, which doesn't mean that it works for all people, because people are still people, whether they're poets or artists or whatever they do. But for us, it works really well. We've done a ton of collaborating in the past 10 years that we've been together. We've run an online literary and art magazine called Aperçu for about 9 years. We ran a visiting writer series where we invited out-of-town poets to come to Joshua Tree to read. What else, Jonathan?
We drove here together.
We sure did, in the same car.
Yeah, we collaborate a lot. And one of the really cool things about being married to a fellow writer and fellow poet is that, you know, you have a live-in reader and editor. And Lauren really is the best reader of my work. She's very careful and attentive and compassionate, and we both feel like we want the work to be as strong as it can be, so we don't waste any time with hurt feelings or anything like that. We can cut straight to it.
I always know that Jonathan is going to be straight with me when and I can see, I'm watching him, so I can see what's happening on his face when I'm reading him something.
Right.
I kind of know halfway through, like, what's happening on his face, whether or not I took a wrong turn somewhere.
Well, yeah, and for me as well. And you mentioned in your question, Ben, do we feed off each other? I feel like we do.
Absolutely.
I steal my best ideas from Lauren.
Yeah, we inspire each other all the time, and we don't get jealous of each other. And whenever Jonathan has a success with his writing, I truly feel like it's a success for me as well. I feel just as excited when he gets a publication, a review published, a poem published, is invited to speak somewhere. It's really exciting.
Yeah, and I also want to take this opportunity to say I know that for some couples this is nauseating because, you know, it's like, oh, you know, how is there no competition? I mean, Lauren's my best friend, so we start off with friendship, and the compatibility is, you know, through the roof. Just, I want to be around her. So naturally, the writing is an extension of that. We talk about lesson plans and challenges in the classroom and, you know, new writers. Everything is just grist for the mill, good stuff to talk about.
Currently, we teach at Crafton College, and currently we both teach English, and this semester we share a wall, so I can hear Jonathan talking on the other side of the wall. I can hear his jokes, and there was one time when he told his only joke that he knows, which is about a talking muffin, which we won't do right now. But when he said, "Hey guys, I have a joke," and when he started it, I was mouthing it on the other side of the wall.
So yeah, I need to revise my previous comment about competition, because when it comes to the joke-o-meter,
yeah, that's true.
Or the applause-o-meter, that's where we're both hams.
Maybe I mean, a little bit more competitive in that way.
Well, I have a background in performing music, and Lauren has a background in theater and drama. So we're both hams. So when it comes to getting our students to laugh, there's our competitive streak.
So you imagine kind of this archetypal creative person needs an anchor person who's not creative, you know?
Yeah.
Needs kind of this grounding person. And so for you, is it like just two poles of existential angst? Or like, what is it like? I mean, clearly it works, but what is it? How does that work?
Go ahead, angsty.
Well, he's clearly monitoring me in my...
He has cameras.
In my daily existential struggles. Yeah, it can be that mutual spinning out
sometimes.
Yeah,
we can spiral each other up or down. We went to grad school together as well. So talk about stress. And we can either amp each other up in the stressed out, oh my God, what do we do with our lives? Or we can calm each other down. So we've realized that we're both really influential on the other person when it comes to having an emotional response. So we try to be aware of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Lauren, 9 times out of 10, is the cool cucumber, whereas I'm the one going, what does it all mean? Wrestling with that, for better or worse. But we end up balancing each other out. We just have to go on plenty of walks and talk a lot. I do know a lot of couples who have that. I know exactly what you're talking about, the grounding partner or the grounded partner and the sort of, you know, the balloon. You know, you have to have a kid holding onto the balloon. Otherwise, it can run into the power lines.
And yet, even though we're both artists, we also both have pragmatic sides. We're planners. We analyze. We're also pretty grounded in time and space. That's how we
try to be.
Getting
a little better
time today.
Yeah, Lauren's much better with time. I'm better with space.
Yeah,
like, don't ask her to read a map, and don't ask me to get out the door on time.
But together, you made it here.
Exactly.
Together. Yep.
So you two are living in the high desert area in Yucca Valley, and Lauren, you grew up in Joshua Tree. How does the desert setting affect your work?
Yeah, I think this is a question that we can both speak to, because Jonathan's lived in the desert for several years now, too. I was born and raised there. I graduated from high school, from Yucca Valley High School, and I've returned as an adult multiple times. The desert keeps calling me back. I was an only child, and my parents worked a lot, so I had a lot of time alone to think, and I started writing at a very young age. I have an obligation to write about the desert, not because I love it. I think that if I wrote about it because I love it, I'm not sure if it would be the kind of writing that I want to produce. I try not to idealize the desert. And if I do end up mythologizing the desert at all, there's a darkness to it, because there is a darkness to the desert. And there's both. There is light and there is dark. And I really try to capture both. What about you, Jonathan?
Well, one of the coolest things about living where we live is that, you know, we're on 5 acres. And when I'm living in a neighborhood, the external tends to mirror the internal, or vice versa, rather. So I tend to feel pretty crowded in a neighborhood. Whereas out on acreage, I feel like my imagination can breathe and stretch, and that affects me in all positive ways. The other thing is that there are a lot of sharp objects and critters out in the desert, which drives a lot of people away and freaks them out, which, okay, that's fine. It's not for everybody. But I like that about it, because it brings me into the moment, and it makes me appreciative and respectful of my surroundings. And sure, I found a big scorpion under my bed one time, and, you know, we've had rattlesnakes in the yard, and some of the plants look like, you know, weaponry, but I dig that. So I've just sort of learned to give the flora and fauna respectful proximity, and I see that as beauty, you know, wrestling some of the beauty from what a lot of people consider as ugliness. But I think it's beautiful.
I would say that, you know, some people's junk is some people's treasure, sure. But yeah, there's a lot of actual just junk that features prominently in my work, and I would say also in your work, Jonathan. We have lots of nouns, and most of those nouns are rusty, sharp.
Yeah.
I grew up with actual junk piles in my backyard, because my father collected junk. you know, shards of goblets and bottles and masonry nails and rusted wire and marbles and half-buried toy soldiers and rare coins and railroad ties, just things that he pilfered. And so the junk pile features pretty prominently in both Desert with a Cabin View and my latest book, Starshine Road. It's something that is returned to over and over again. And you have a lot of objects in your work as well.
Yeah, I wrote a poem about visiting the landfill, you know, and sort of seeing busted objects as sort of calling to me, or, you know, still having a kind of life or vitality. But, you know, in our current place when we moved in, what's kind of interesting, I'm still finding pennies all over the place.
Old ones.
I found one from 1902 or something just hanging out in the yard. But I find shards of glass and bits of Christmas ornaments and little
smashed
toy
TV
figures
screen.
From a game, like a board game. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. And for poets, that's just great. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm late everywhere I go. It's because I'm like, oh, look at this. And after it rains, I go outside and find all my treasures. And marbles, really great old marbles. So anyway, we can go on and on. But the landscape provides those. It's like living in a giant machine that's constantly churning out writing prompts or topics
Definitely.
To explore on the page.
If you know how to look for it.
If you know how to look for it, you know.
If you know how to look.
Yeah. So writing is a way of seeing, we've heard people say before, and I agree. And so if you can see that and revalue it, yeah, I think you can really ring out and get a lot of inspiration out of wherever you live.
That was Lauren Henley and Jonathan Maul presenting a night of music and poetry November 17th at the Joshua Tree Art Gallery at 3 p.m. I'm Benjamin Perper. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming online at kvcrnews.org. So that darkness that Lauren finds in the desert, you find that a lot too then, Jonathan, right?
I do, and it appeals to me, I guess, because of my upbringing and because of my worldview. I'm drawn to some of the darkness. I have a sort of morbid fascination with mass incarceration, studying it, reading about it, you know, teaching lessons that have to do with it and trying to raise awareness. And, you know, other really depressing subjects that don't actually bring me down. The closer I get to them, the more I talk about them, the more I engage with them, the more I feel like I'm able to gain a purchase or a handle on some of that. Even if I'm just, you know, fooling myself, it feels that way. So I'm drawn to some of the dark elements in the desert too. For example, you know, not everybody moves to a rural space for the same reason. Some people move out to the desert for somewhat nefarious purposes, and yet our neighborhood is full of decent human beings who, you know, seem to stick to themselves and wave when we drive by, and we've had no problems. But it's both. It's both. And I think if you forget one or, you know, sacrifice one, you end up, you know, making a Thomas Kincaid painting. And that's not what I'm trying to do with my work. No offense, Thomas.
He has so much money, he probably doesn't mind.
Oh, yeah.
He's
I think
fine.
He's okay.
We're the poor ones.
He can weather the storm that is Jonathan
We're
Maul.
The poor ones with our darkness.
And the desert is still showing up a lot in your work, Lauren, right?
Absolutely. My latest book, Starshine Road. Starshine Road is actually the name of the road that I grew up on in Landers. And it holds a lot of weight for me. Landers is a really, it's a fairly depressing place. And it's very isolated. It's even more isolated than Joshua Tree. We were home invaded, essentially, when I was in the third grade. And I just spent a whole lot of time alone. But I got a lot of really great stories out of it. And I have another book coming out in October 2019 called Whole Night Through. And that also takes place in the desert. It's a novel in verse. And it's also fairly dark in content and loosely based on some true murder stories that happened in that area. So yes, I continue to write about the desert. I don't think I can get away from it.
I was just going to say, you can't not write about the desert.
I can't not. You know, there are infinite areas of my brain to explore in this area. It's my imaginative landscape.
Yeah, and I just want to say that the desert is wrongly assumed to be barren of life.
Yes.
But it is absolutely teeming with life. We don't live in Death Valley. There's a huge difference between high and low desert. And so when I tell some extended family members or friends who haven't been out to visit where I live, they're imagining Mars. And the truth is, you know, sometimes we as Americans, I think, view, if I can make an overarching like generalization, you know, poetry as, you know, sort of devoid of nutrient, but it's teeming with it. We just have to be able to unlock it and see it and engage with it. So that's my pitch for poetry and the desert. I see them as working together in similar ways and similarly overlooked.
That was Lauren Henley and Jonathan Mall. Again, their music and poetry event is November 17th at 3 p.m. at the Joshua Tree Art Gallery. I'm Benjamin Perper. Now here's Lauren and Jonathan with a reading of some of their original work.
Desert with a cabin view. You could look at it in a couple of ways. You can look at it as one long poem in 21 parts. They're essentially little proverbs that if you look at them one way, they make sense and they offer wisdom. And if you look at them another way, they're just sort of silly. I've had audiences laugh really loud at these poems before, which is great. So I'll just read a couple. When I was young, there was never a cave to live in. Never one just right. Now that I don't need one, they are everywhere, like whole numbers. Wind never starts close by, but arrives like the threat of footsteps. The number 8 clanks on a neighbor's address. It will lie on its side, infinity. If your stomach eats itself, you've waited too long, and there is no point in going to market. You will have to wait for the cycle to finish and the loud, protracted buzzer. If your heart falls in love with itself, it will forget to do anything else, and you will die. A small sacrifice. Okay, I'll just read one of my junk poems from Starshine Road. Junk pile as seen from inside the junk pile. Heavy blue insulators stolen from New Mexico telephone poles. Stovepipe pilfered from a gutted cabin. Stack of shingles the color of lunch meat. Plastic bin of horseshoes cracking under sun. Blades of a metal windmill mimicking a clock face. Ice cream scoop existing without moving parts to break. There is nothing here that I want. So then, how do I explain my love?
This is in three sections, so I'll just go ahead and get started. Language, a toy frog. 1. After the belly of another summer has taken its share, the bugs and their searching disappear along with the hot ribbons of sound from passing cars. The rubber on asphalt cooled, shoulders relaxed and open. All these nouns no longer busied. We say cause and effect, casually, handling our words cheap as plastic frogs. Press their backs, they will jump. In the classroom, I asked a dozen Marines why we toss around language like God bless you. Why, if healing is our line of work, don't we abandon everything right now and get to blessing? Healing like mad, the rising tide of the broken and the sick. They must think I'm damaged goods, lost in the page's white space. I can see how the shine of my 20s was really a grease spot. But that's not it, at least not precisely. I am simply amazed at the cages. The next time I'm arrested, may it be for corrupting the youth. May a young man see himself without flinching, and may language rain into the water table of my ear, unlocking me. 2. There is enough firewood, so we warm the belly of the house. Stew knuckle bones in the black crock pot, read poetry, wear our thick jackets and boots, watch the moon while our visible breath leads us in loops around the property. Later, spring glides, drunk. Rain falls, cleaning the bald head of a gourd. And the earth drinks. Beneath our feet, water sits in taproots, a cathedral of egg shacks, glowing, so much waiting to break free. 3. I look to the calendar's final ideas of a year, the glorious dose of a new year's stupidity we dissolve on our tongues, as though the wolves have lost our scent. Winter makes a living thing of me. I don't mean to say I'm dead and dragged, dashing my head against the coffee tables of other seasons, just that winter demands that I be me again, to see the tree as a source of heat and gather it, to see my breath, to know the cold and reckon with it, the air and the moon's empty face.
That was Jonathan Maul and Lauren Henley in conversation with KVCR's Benjamin Perper. And more poetry and music, Saturday, November 17th at the Joshua Tree Art Gallery. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. It's comedy for the rest of the program. Comedy in our region soon. Here's Emmanuel Rogers once again.
Joining us today is comedian Gad Elmaleh. Gad recently finished shooting his new Netflix series, Huge in France, and you can also see him on YouTube with Conan O'Brien and The Tonight Show's Jimmy Fallon. Gad Elmaleh is one of the biggest and most recognizable comedic talents in the world. Gad's first English language special, Gad Elmaleh, American Dream, is now available on Netflix. Gad will also be appearing at the Wilshire Ebell Theater in Los Angeles, California, on November 13th. Thank you for joining us today, Gad.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Man, this is my pleasure. I've been watching, you know, some of your things online, on YouTube, and some other mediums, and, man, you keep me laughing, and I do appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, I hope you're feeling better after being under the weather last week. How are you doing?
Great. You know, it's the biggest tour I've ever made because we traveled all over Europe, and you know, doing a show in English allows you, you know, as you guess, to go to different countries. When I used to do only French for more than 20 years,
wow.
I would go only to French territories and France. But now I can go and travel the world, and it's a great experience.
Yeah. Now, you've been on the Dream Tour since September 20th. Will you share with us how it's going, and how have you been received around the world?
It's really interesting because the crowd is a very mixed crowd of people. Like if I go to Sweden, of course I'll have Swedish people because of Netflix special. They have Netflix and they, you know, discover talents and they know my work. But also I have expats from France because I'm from there.
Right.
I have expats from Morocco because I was born in Morocco and raised in Morocco. And it's always a diverse crowd. It's really fun.
Right.
But the common thing is the English, is the language. And the reason why I'm able to do soon China, Dubai, or Sweden is because it's the English. So it's great.
Now, do I have this right? You've actually moved to America, to Los Angeles?
Yeah. To New York. I worked in L.A. I won't move to L.A. No.
But
I don't know. I love going there. I love working there. I love this lifestyle in L.A.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know. I feel I'm not from here. I'm not American. I'm not a New Yorker. But when I get to New York, as soon as I land there, I'm like, oh, I feel at home.
Now, you have been performing around the world and are well known for bringing laughter to many. Why the move to America from France?
Wow, that's that was a big challenge, you know?
Yeah.
You do something for so many years, and then you need to get excited again. Honestly, I had the American dream for a long time. I know today, for Americans, this doesn't mean a lot, but believe me, for foreigners, it means a lot, and I still believe in it, even if it's not easy.
Right.
You know, before coming to America, I had the American dream, and being able to be on stage in a different language in America in front of Americans, it's the American dream, you know?
Yeah.
I was born in a very, like, poor family in Morocco, and made it to France and now to America. I still believe in your American dreams, and I think Americans should remember that dream. It's a great dream.
Well, I had a dream of moving to France at one time, too, and I really do like Paris.
So. Yeah, it's called the French nightmare.
Paris was really great, but made it better for me is I stopped going to the tourist places and start hanging out with just French people, and then it became wonderful.
Yeah, but now that you know me, I should take you around the Paris and show you the great places. And, of course, the tourist places are never the best, but I know some great places in Paris. It's a beautiful and wonderful city. I'm also a big jazz music fan.
Oh.
You know, I love in Paris those jazz plays and in New York, obviously. And wherever I go on tour, even in Europe, I go listen to jazz music because I wanted to be a jazz musician when I was a kid.
How did that work out?
It's just I play music. I play piano, but not good enough to become a professional musician. And I was lazy to work too much on the practicing and everything. So now I'm just a fan, and it's much easier to be a fan, right?
Yeah, yes, it is.
They have a big festival here in Montreal. They have big festivals in Europe, so I go all the time. And I really love it. It's my thing. And I listen to jazz music all the time on the road.
What's the biggest adjustment that you've had to make coming from France to America?
Well, besides the language, mm-hmm. there's one little funny thing. When I started to play clubs, which we don't have in France, we have theaters, but we don't have comedy clubs where people eat, drink. Right. It was strange to me. Like, I would perform and I had like this guy sitting front row with a burger in his mouth. It's weird for us. Like, we don't know that. And I had to learn how to perform in those places where people just hang out, have fun, have dinner, you know.
Right.
You see everything. You see them paying the bill, giving the tip, calling the waiter. And it's kind of distracting, but you learn. And it's a new way of doing comedy in those small clubs. I do theaters on tour. But that was an adjustment. That was learning really how to perform in those places. And when you can make it there, it's good. You can go to a theater and it's easy and smooth.
For just a moment, I want to change to something and ask you if you wouldn't mind to take a moment to share with our audience where they can find out more about your Wilshire Ebel Theater appearance and also where they can find out more about you online.
Of course. So now I have my special on Netflix. It's called The American Dream. So I have a website. It's called gadcomedy.com where they can find all the info about the tour and the show in California at the Wilshire Ebel Theater. Et voilà.
For our listeners, Gad can also be seen on YouTube. You can find many things about him also online. Just put his name in there, Gad Elmaleh, and you will be surprised at the laughter he's going to bring to you. Now, I do understand, I've heard before that you were French-Moroccan, and you just confirmed it. Yeah. What was the transition like leaving Morocco to live in France?
You know, not much, but the second language in Morocco is French, because Morocco was colonized, as you know, by French. And French culture is very, very present in Morocco. But the great thing is I was able to learn Arabic, of course, and not even learn because it was a natural thing. You know, sometimes people say, oh, wow, you also speak Arabic. And I'm like, no, wow, I just grew up there and I spoke Arabic in the streets. And it's really interesting because I'm from a Jewish family in Morocco, Sephardic. We don't really know those stories. It's really interesting, the Jewish community of Morocco. There was a really golden age of peace and harmony between the two people, Muslim and Jewish people.
Right.
And I just want to mention a very short story about that.
Please.
Is one of the kings of Morocco named Mohammed V, when the Nazis started to come to France and take all the Jews to take them to the camps, they tried to go to Morocco and to take the Jews and bring them to the camps in France and in Germany. And the king of Morocco, the Mohammed V, said, these Jews are Moroccans, they are my people, and they protect them. And it's a story nobody knows. As a Muslim leader talking about his people, no matter what they were Jewish or not, and they were Moroccans and they were... It's a beautiful story that we are thankful as Jewish Moroccans, you know. So I always like to remember that because those little stories make the big history.
Yes, they do. Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to understand and know because, like you said, it isn't something that's widely known around the world at the time.
No, not at all. Not at all. And also that there was a very big Jewish community in Morocco, you know, and they lived in the same streets, celebrating each one his traditions and rituals for their own religion, and it was a lot of respect. I like to remember that, you know, in a time where people are just, we're not really united. We need that. So it's a weird time, you know?
Yeah. I have to ask you, will you be taking, I believe it's Conan O'Brien that you're going to take to Morocco with you at some point?
Yeah. So, I can't wait because he's curious. He wants to know, learn, go play with the cultures. And I love that. He brings to the world, to the media, to the Americans. All it's great. You know, there was one show. He was wonderful. Rest in peace, Bourdain. I love this man when he was doing his shows because Anthony Bourdain, when I was watching his shows, I was like, oh, it's great because he brings to Americans so much, so much.
Yeah.
Not only the food thing, but the culture and the differences. And it's great, you know. So I would love to share that, and I would love to take Conan to Morocco. So I think it's going to happen. I can't wait.
No, will he stand out in Morocco? I mean, will they, like, notice him right off?
Right away. This big, tall, red guy on a camel? Yeah, he would stand up.
So I'm going to ask you something that I know you've been asked before about the English language. What are some of the challenges and the joys that you have with the language?
You know, there's one American comedian.
Okay.
Who is the only comedian who kind of analyzed, dissect, observed the English language without being a foreigner. I thought only foreigners would. This comedian I'm talking about is George Carlin.
Oh,
and George Carlin, I'm really obsessed these days with his work because I discover now that even someone who is from America, from here, he's American, he grew up as an American, he knows the language, he speaks English, but he's still questioning the language. He's still analyzing. He's still deconstructing, just like a philosopher, the language. I really love his work. I'm obsessed with that. And what I'm doing is pretty inspired by those guys with the language. Like, language for you is, you know, just normal, some expressions and everything. But it's good to have a perspective from someone who doesn't know that language, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you come to France, you're going to ask me so many things about the language. How do you say this? Why do you say that? And the outsider perspective, this is what I try to bring. But also I discovered that English language for the stand-up is great. It's a great tool for stand-up because it's sharp, it's efficient, and we don't use a lot of words. French comedy is very wordy, long stories. I love American comedy. All the comedians are just obsessed with one thing. It's narrow and like cutting the fat and cutting the... It's really interesting. In French,
like that,
we have long stories. Too long, but they are charming. Sometimes American comics just stand there and they deliver jokes. We need some charm and moves and a little acting sometimes.
Yeah.
So I try to mix both.
I understand. You completed a residency at Joe's Pub in New York City, and then you appeared at a sold-out show at the world-famous Carnegie Hall. What was that like, and where do you go from Carnegie Hall? I mean, really.
Oh, wow. You know, I was so nervous that day. My producers said we're going to do Carnegie Hall, and I was very impressed.
Right.
It's funny, I called my mom in France when I knew I was going to do Carnegie Hall, and I said, I'm going to do Carnegie Hall, and she said, what is that? And I tried to explain what Carnegie Hall was, and she compared it to a venue in Paris. She said, oh, he's got the venue. Can we say it's like the Olympia you did 20 years ago? And I said, yes. She came to New York, and she said something beautiful that night I will never forget. She was walking in the lobby, and she saw a picture of Frank Sinatra. And she had tears in her eyes. And she came up to me, and she's like, you're going to perform in a room where Frank Sinatra performed many years ago. And I said, yeah, that's what I was trying to tell you, Mom. And she started, like, really to be really emotional. And I said, what do you have, Mom? What's going on? Tell me. How do you feel? And she said, I'm really nervous tonight. And she said, but not just nervous. Like, she said, I'm nervous. But she said, you know this kind of nervous I was when you first started 20 years ago? Oh, I guess even now I get a little emotional to talk about it. But she said, I'm scared. it's like when you first started in France more than 20 years ago and you did your first stage, you remember we would come to this little theater and just family in the room, and you first started, even if it's a big room, it's Carnegie Hall, the press is here and people are here. I feel like you're starting over again, and I'm nervous about that. Whoa. And I will keep that as a really strong emotional experience and remembering that, you know, where we come from.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I would have had to ask my mom, well, you know what, now you have to go on for me.
That's great. You bring the punchline. I love it. This is not an interview. This is a conversation, and I
yes,
love that.
Thank you. Well, what projects are you working on that we don't know about and should look out for in the future?
The thing that I'm really working on now is writing the series, but you mentioned it earlier, Huge in France. That's what I'm working on. I'm working also, I don't think people will look at it, but just so you know what's going on in my brain, I'm working also on a new show in French, because I love going from French to English, English to French, because I learn things from different language.
Right.
There is one story somebody told me about a famous ping pong player who broke his hand one day, and he said, I'm going to start over with the left hand. He said, it's going to be hard. He said, it's okay, I'm going to learn and start over. And so he learned. He didn't do as good as with the right hand, but one day they asked him, so what have you learned? And he said, you know what? I've learned so much about my right hand that I thought I knew. And this is exactly how I feel. When I do stand up in English, sometimes I stop, I go back to French, and I'm like, oh, now I can understand, because I took kind of step back and I did English, and now I go back to the French and I can be more humble and analyze and be more curious and more researched. Yeah. And more, you know, I don't take it for granted and just write jokes in French now. It's just, it helps me to do a different language so I can, you know, not compare, but challenge it and go from one to the other. It's really exciting.
Yeah, you get some great perspectives on looking at things in ways
that... Yeah, that's the perspective. Yeah. That's the word. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, it's easy for me. That's the only language I know. Thank you. My mother's happy about it, too. Yeah, sure. I understood when she told me, boy, shut up. It's like, yeah, I understood that, Mom.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Gad, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a wonderful
conversation. Oh, no, I thank you. Really, it was really fun. Really, really fun. I can't wait to be in California and play the Wiltshire Ebel Theater. Voilà. Merci beaucoup. Thank you so much.
You are more than welcome, and I look forward. I hope we have an opportunity to speak again.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with comedian Gad Elmaleh, again at the Wilshire Theater, Los Angeles, November 13th. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Gad and Emmanuel, Jonathan Maul and Lauren Henley, and author Michael S. Engel. Here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Lillian Vasquez, Isel Quapio, Benjamin Perper, Shireen Awad, Trisha Ahmed, Jesse Rosales, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So as always, thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVCR's programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.